it can ignite. And all you gotta do is bring the light. Cause a new light shines. Shalom, everyone. Welcome to episode 28 of the Light Lab podcast. I'm Eliana. It's so great to be with you, new listeners and old listeners alike, coming to you from a very beautiful and sweaty August in Durham, North Carolina. It's so great to get to have these conversations about tefillah, prayer, liturgy, and spirituality, and to revisit some interviews that I did earlier in the summer, including this next one with my dear friend, an incredible practitioner and teacher of tefillah and communal singing, and a beautiful melodic voice, harmonies up the wazoo. Friends, I'm so excited to share with you my interview with now Rabbi Deborah Sachs Mintz. Rabbi Deborah Sachs Mintz serves the Hadar Institute as Director of Tefillah and Music. What an incredible title, the perfect position for the perfect person. An educator, practitioner, and facilitator of Jewish communal prayer, Deborah serves and supports communities and individuals who seek to deepen, sharpen, and unlock their practice of empowered song and tefillah. She has collaborated with a diverse array of different Jewish musicians. She's been on over 24 albums, incredible. Her first record of original spiritual music, The Narrow and the Expanse, such a beautiful album that came out in 2020. She is also part of Joey Weisenberg's Hadar Ensemble. Rabbi Josh Rashosky, third chair, friend of the pod, on the pod, he is the pod, Chavurai Nevarech Band, and New Moon Rising with our friends Alana Arian and Chava Morel. Rabbi Sachs Mintz received rabbinic ordination from the Jewish Theological Seminary, where she also earned her MA in Women and Gender Studies. She holds degrees in music and religious anthropology from the University of Michigan, and you can learn more about Deborah's work at www.deborahsachsmintz.com. Don't worry, we will be including all of those links in the show notes. Listen to this episode and stick around to hear the title track from Deborah's album, a beautiful version of Min HaMeitzar, which she'll talk about. And please enjoy my interview with Rabbi Deborah Sachs Mintz. Well, hi, Deborah. It's so great to be with you today.
Eliana, thank you so much for having me. This is a treat.
I know it's been a while since we've been in the same room singing together. So being in the same Zoom talking, not the same, but pretty great.
It's definitely close.
Definitely close. So we're going to talk about tefillah, of course, the subject of this podcast and one of my favorite things to talk about. But I want to start with your childhood. What was your relationship to tefillah growing up when you were a kid?
That's a great question. And I love thinking back to that time. I grew up in a really beautiful community in Riverdale in the Bronx. And being immersed in my shul tefillah experience was actually a pretty defining and formative part of my Jewish journey. When I was around 12 and I was studying for my bat mitzvah, I was really captivated by this idea that Jewish adults are all not just empowered, but in many ways seen as responsible for the sort of spiritual well-being of their community through leadership. And that not only was every adult responsible for that, but that as a 13-year-old, I counted as an adult, and that in this sort of world where I was basically a child in all aspects of life, that I was seen as an equally responsible part of this community. And that was really my primary relationship to tefillah, that it was something that I could be responsible for and embedded within as my own autonomous self, and that I could find that through music. It was very, very powerful as a child.
That is a really beautiful way to look at it. And was the music kind of the inroad for you? Was that what drew you to the experience itself, in addition to the empowerment piece?
I'd say the sort of meditative, mindful aspect of traditional nusach as a musical modality. I was a musician from a from a very young age. Cello was my first instrument. And then I always loved to sing, but actually leading tefillah was my sort of first access point into finding my voice. And the melodies of traditional prayer really drew me in.
How old were you when you started leading tefillah?
I was learning already in junior congregation when I was 8 or 9, and we all kind of took leadership roles in that context. But I really dove right in for my bat mitzvah and then became part of the rotation in my shul.
And at that time, I'm assuming, or maybe not, that it's changed and we'll talk about it. But at that time, what did you see your role as a leader of tefillah?
I think I pretty quickly, and I really credit this to the clergy of my shul, I think I pretty quickly saw myself as like part of the lay leadership of the shul, and that my ability to lead tefillah was an integral part of my way of contributing to my community. I think I saw that as a teen.
That's really incredible to have clergy who want to support and uplift young folks. That's really beautiful. As you kind of grew up, left your home community, were there any experiences along your young adulthood, any teachers that you had that started to focus or shift or change your understanding of what tefillah is or could be?
Well, interestingly, when I went off to college and I studied classical voice at the University of Michigan School of Music, I really sort of left Jewish communal life for a period at that point and immersed myself both in the conservatory and in sort of took a deep dive into the study of ethnomusicology. And through that, I began to learn with scholars and professors and practitioners that were studying the way music as sort of an active process actualizes and ignites and activates communities. And I started to study how music shows up in faith-based communities, not Jewish specifically. So I'd say that at that point in my life, a lot of the people that I was studying music in cultures around the world, and sort of some of the very sort of physical embodied parts of classical music, thinking specifically about my choral conducting professor, Dr. Paul Reardon, some of these folks, I think, in retrospect, actually were really formative mentors in tefillah, even though that was not the modality of music or of prayer or of musical practice and community with which they were working.
I think that's really incredible, though. We see so many, or at least you, because you've been immersed in both, can find those threads. What are some other pieces from your classical training that you have found support or uplift your tefillah leadership? What are some of the corollaries there? I know nothing about classical music, by the way, so this is very exciting for me.
Well, I actually think the concept of kevan kavana, which is, you know, as you do know, Eliana, is a crucial part of how we think of the practice of prayer, right? The keva, that which is fixed, and the kavana, that which is fluid, spontaneous, or the form and the fire, as we call it. I'd say that's an integral part of not just classical music, but any really serious study of any type of musical form that has a fixed system that's there to serve the artistic purpose, and that only when that is sort of mastered to some degree or internalized intensely within the body or as a string player, first and foremost within the hands, a little more amorphous in the voice inside the body, only when it's internalized can the kavana, can the fluid, more creative, artistic sparks emerge. And I think that that is something that in the ebb and flow between being a musical practitioner and a prayer practitioner, that really translates and is, I think, a very useful dichotomy to sort of have internalized.
Yeah, while you were talking, I was imagining almost the words of the Siddur as a musical score, like without even thinking about Nusach yet, just as a classical cellist unless they are a composer themselves or playing pieces that someone else wrote that came from a place deep within them, we too are given this score, but it's words instead of music, which adds another layer of poetic beauty and also complexity. I don't know. That's kind of a nice image. I'm wondering where that takes you.
Yeah, that is a beautiful image. It is funny that you mentioned the nusach right in there as sort of, that's not even necessarily the right comparison, right? We could say the music notes in a, you know, Bach cello suite are, you know, are to the music as the nusach is to the prayer. But I would agree with you. It's much more like looking at the words of the Psalms, right? It's we're offered a fixed form as the container for that which is too confusing or too complicated or too scary or too beautiful to formulate without some kind of rooted history and some kind of form to give it beauty. And I would say that is sort of what the notes on the page are. They're like the words of our prayers, of our Psalms.
So you experience this more classical vocal training, this classical musical training. What else happened along that path to lead you back into Jewish community?
Well, along the way in my conservatory studies at Michigan, as I mentioned, I started taking a deep dive into ethnomusicology and into how music shows up in faith-based communities. And that took me on a lot of traveling and a lot of study of religions and musical cultures from around the world, doing field work around the world. And eventually I began to feel a calling to start to ask myself, where does this show up in my own faith-based community? Where does this show up in my own tradition, in my own soul, in my own background? All of these concepts of music, not as a universal language, but music as a language is universal. Where does that show up in specifics in my own life, in my own connection to that which is greater than myself? So that's where that began to take me.
That's incredible. Do you have particular memories from your time doing field work that sparked new thoughts in you or new curiosities in you about your Jewish community, but in places that weren't in that community?
Yeah, so one summer I was doing some work in South India. I was in a program studying the intersection between classical Carnatic singing, which is the style of classical music in South India, the intersection between that music and meditation theory. And we were studying a chant that is said at the end of a practice. And the translation of this chant immediately struck me as almost identical to Oseh Shalom. And I wasn't just struck by the, you know, translation similarities. Of course, you know, religions around the world have similar concepts of prayers for peace. That's not unusual. I was struck more by my own reaction to noticing it, that I felt this strange sort of emotional kinship to that moment that went far beyond just sort of like noticing similarities between like my religion and someone else's religion. And that really stuck with me. I came back home and sort of began to flip through the pages of the Siddur in a way I hadn't in years, with a deeper curiosity into looking at what are the texts that we say in the beginning, in the middle, in the end of our practices, our prayer practices, our mindfulness practices, our embodied and spoken and moments of study that mark our connection to God, and what are the statements that we say? What are our fundamental core statements? And really, that was one moment that sort of began to draw me back deeply into Jewish prayer.
I'm wondering if along your experiences, or maybe as you're starting to come back, if you're thinking about the difference between prayer and tefillah, which is something we talk about a lot in this space, could you have articulated that then? And even if not, is there a way that you're thinking about it now?
Yeah, I mean, I think coming back to this concept of kevan kavana, you know, I spoke about it a moment ago in much more kind of generalist terms, right? The fixed parts of an experience that allow for the outpouring of the creativity and the spark. But when I think of prayer versus tefillah, and I think of Jewish prayer, lehit palel, I think of the specifics of the keva being really crucial for the kavana to come out, that the rhythms of Jewish prayer, the texts of Jewish prayer, the sounds of Jewish prayer, the physical embodiments of Jewish prayer, that those specifics are really there in order to center the kavana of Jewish prayer. And I find tremendous depth and comfort in that process.
I find this really interesting because I also grew up in a traditional davening, one might say, sort of community where the rhythms became ingrained in me. And that does very often support my own kavana. And yet, for so many people who did not grow up that way or who have not sought it out in such a deep way, that which we consider entry points can be seen as barriers. So I'm wondering, in your experience now as a tefillah educator, we're skipping ahead a little bit. So if you have things to fill in from how you got from there to here, we can fill in those shades. But something I think about a lot is, how can we make tefillah accessible to folks who have not had that background while still keeping the things in tefillah that make it particular?
That's a great question. And I'll say that if I had like a really, really, really good clear answer for that, then, you know, I would have I'd crack the code. And I think we're all
right.
I think all of us who are tefillah educators, not the least of which yourself, a magnificent tefillah educator who I've admired for many years, you know, we're all on that journey of trying to balance the, you know, the general and the specific, the accessibility, and I think the real beauty of secrets and of mystery, right? There's some actual, I think there's spiritual power to it not being 100% accessible, to not knowing every word, to still wondering and not always being sure. I personally actually really enjoy the moments where I'm not totally sure what page we're on, and I have to kind of do the work of finding that to me is its own spiritual practice.
So you come back to the Siddur, to your Jewish tradition. How does that bring you into not just being a practitioner of prayer, but a professional teacher and leader and composer of tefillah?
After I felt this calling back into sort of reviewing and revisiting my deep connection to shul, to prayer, to observance, to tefillah, and reigniting that in myself, I began to work in congregational education, in youth and family education, in shuls, first full-time as part of a congregational education team, and then eventually as the director of the education program. And I was also beginning to compose Jewish music, collaborate with Jewish musicians, experimenting with leading davening again, eventually joining the davening team of Minyanim and founding a minyan. And all of these explorations together put me on a path into rabbinical school, where I'm right now finishing up in my final few weeks of my smicha program. And as I studied through rabbinical school, deepening my, not just my own relationship and process to prayer and Jewish music and leading prayer and composing Jewish music, but creating pathways and systems by which others can feel as connected and empowered and ignited and curious and really responsible as members of the Jewish community, as I was fortunate enough to as an adolescent and later in life. And that's a lot of the work that I think about now.
It's really incredible, passing that on so that other people are able to feel empowered in their own communities. I want to take a step back before going forward, as we are wont to do. I'm thinking about the parallels between your Jewish tefillah journey and your songwriting journey, knowing that they are not totally separate. They're definitely intertwined. But do you see something in one that has taught you something in the other? How has your songwriting affected your prayer life? Has it affected your prayer life?
Whoa, that is an amazing question. How has my songwriting affected my prayer life? I'll say that I find songwriting to be actually a very demanding practice that takes a lot of discipline and does not for me come naturally. I do not feel songs and melodies like kind of pouring out of me. I have many colleagues for whom that is how they experience it, and that's beautiful. But I actually, my process in writing music, and especially music for prayer, is very disciplined and has a structure and usually an intention and usually a purpose that is actually not emotional until later. It's quite fixed in its approach, and then takes on emotional power once the melody has already come to light. And as I say this, I'm thinking a lot about this great midrash that kind of imagines David HaMelech, King David's composition practice in a similar way. And the first time I read this midrash, I was like, oh, now I feel better about the fact that like songs don't always just like pour out of me, but that it's actually part of a spiritual practice discipline. So this midrash, which is from Psachim in the Babylonian Talmud, it looks with curiosity at the fact that there are some psalms that begin Le David Mizmor and some psalms that begin with Mizmor Le David. And one means of David a psalm, the other means a psalm of David. And the rabbis, of course, couldn't just let this go. They couldn't just say, okay, different psalms, different beginnings. There must be a reason David HaMelech sort of started these differently. So what does the Midrash say? It says, if a psalm begins with Le David Mizmor, of David a psalm, this teaches that the Shekhinah, that the divine presence, rested upon him first, and afterwards he recited the song. However, if the psalm opens Mizmor Le David, a psalm of David, this teaches that he first recited the song, and afterwards the Shekhinah, the divine presence, rested upon him. So in this midrash, we sort of have this picture of this you know, composer for whom, you know, we can imagine that songwriting was somewhat of a spiritual and creative calling. And yet there were moments where like it wasn't this sort of this musical outpouring of divine connection. It was like, I'm going to sit down and write this song. And it is through the act of writing a song and creating this melody that I'll access the divine. And that is the order. I have to do it first and then it will come. And we can attribute those psalms to Mizmor Le David, a psalm of David. And I feel very inspired with the second half of that midrash, with the first you write it and then there is a divine connection that comes after, because I think that that often defines my process, which has become a very rich spiritual process for me.
That is such a beautiful midrash. I'd never heard that before. And so great that you were able to find yourself reflected in it. And to me, going back to what you said earlier, it's almost as if you have to create your own keva first, that you create the structure through which a divine experience can happen once it becomes a part of you, once it becomes embodied and enmeshed in you. And since you brought up the Shekhinah, the divine presence, I'm wondering, both in your prayer leadership and in your music writing, where is God in all of this, in how you understand that to be?
Where's God in all of this? I mean, I think coming back to this question of like the mystery and the secrets, I think I don't know where God is in it, and that's good for me. That's okay. And I think that's sort of part of the reason why we can say the same words every day, multiple times a day, and they do something for us. They show up as new because it's sort of the process of trying to excavate through the layers into the secrets and sort of never fully finding it, which I guess one could feel as a little bit sort of nihilistic, but I find it to be sort of like endless opportunity. Like, I do not have to create the pathways or the structure to try to connect to God. I have everything I need in the Siddur. I have everything I need in the melodies of my ancestors. And part of my job as a prayer is to pray and use those structures as an offering to try to find the secrets of the divine and of God in myself. And part of my job as a facilitator, a shaliach tzibur, or a composer, is to use all of those tools as a way to beautify or enhance or support others in their own excavation of those secrets.
This is really reminding me of Anim Zmirot right now, which is one of my favorite prayer poems, you know, Lada'at Kol Raz Sodecha, to know the deepest depths of your secrets. And it's not like the author of that prayer poem gets there at the end. It is in the longing and the questioning and the excavating that is the point of divine connection, that is the journey itself.
Wow, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Thanks. You're in a good club. Let's turn to your teaching then. I'm really interested in what it takes to teach people and invite them in both to an experience of prayer and into leadership of prayer, given that there are so many aspects, the siddur, the space, the music. How are you thinking about the teaching of tefillah these days?
Well, I spend a lot of time thinking about the teaching of tefillah. I'm really excited to be starting a new position with the Hadar Institute as their director of tefillah and music, serving on the faculty and exploring with those of really all levels and access points what it means to hold the responsibility of leading tefillah and finding access into tefillah. That's one part of my portfolio. And when thinking about sort of beginning to build out one's toolbox of leadership, I usually think of the skills of leadership as like tools in a toolbox, right? Like, we all have a toolbox and we all have an array of tools in the toolbox, and we all need to add more tools to the toolbox. And yet we still all have some already in there. And part of the work is to figure out, what are the tools we already have? What do we need to add in? When I think about developing the tools over time and how that's sort of a lifelong journey, I think about those tools or those skills in sort of three categories. I think about technical skills, which are like, you know, kind of the keva, as we've been talking about, the nusach or the text or the fixed systems we're working with. I think about musical and artistic skills, or what my colleague and mentor Joey Weisenberg calls a sense of artistic joy, which I find really beautiful, because it's not like everyone needs to lead tefillah and needs to be a great musician, but we do need to develop a sense of musical and artistic joy. I think it's a beautiful concept. So technical skills, musical and artistic joy. And then the last category of skills or of tools, humility, confidence, and kavana, which is sort of the most kind of amorphous set of skills to be developing. So I see everyone who finds themselves called into prayer leadership as on a journey of developing their toolbox vis-a-vis those three skill areas. And we all come to the table with different strengths and growing edges, and it's a lifelong process, whether you're a novice or an advanced practitioner. And I feel very called into partnering with others in examining and expanding their skills in those areas.
I love that. And for someone who's just starting out on this journey of becoming a prayer leader and wanting to add more tools to their toolbox, do you have any guiding questions for them? Any questions that would help such a person know where to start?
So when I work with a new student, with an aspiring shliach tzibur or a current shliach tzibur, and I do believe that every Jewish person is either a current or aspiring shliach tzibur, if they so choose and feel called, I actually usually begin with a brief study of part of the opening line from Hilchot Tzvila, from Rambam's Mishneh Torah. And this is, you know, this is a text that's sort of studying the ins and outs of some of the nitty-gritties of Tzvila leadership. It's not narrative, it's not creative, it's not a particularly poetic text. But it has this beautiful line that says, Bashachar kol ha'am yoshvim, at shacharit, in the morning, the whole community is sitting. Ushalech tzibur yored lifnei ha'teva, and the prayer leader yored goes down before the teva, before the ark with the Torah. Ve'omed be'emtza am, and stands within the people. Umatchil, and begins. And it sort of outlines this process that at the beginning of leading prayer, the shliach tzibur has to have both the chutzpah of omed, of standing, be'emtza ha'am, within a community of people who are yoshivim, sitting, takes a lot of chutzpah. But they also have to, as the text says, yored lifnei ha'teva, go down before the ark, this sort of image of like a kind of a humbling. And it raises up that to lead prayer is at once sort of holding chutzpah and humility, which is really, really hard. And we all gravitate more towards one or the other. And I usually ask those who are doing the work of deepening this skill or stepping up into this process to examine which of these postures is more natural to you. How do you balance them out? What tools do you need in order to cultivate both this humility and this chutzpah, this ability to step back and listen in the service of your community, and also to have the courage to stand up and serve?
Not only do you work with prayer leaders and aspiring prayer leaders, but you also work with communities. And I'm wondering, when a community reaches out to you, what are they looking for often? And are there any guiding questions or principles that you use with them? You know, I think that some synagogues, they say they want more meaningful prayer or better prayer, but what does that even mean? So I'm wondering, what are they looking for when they come to you, and what are you hoping to provide for them?
Yeah, well, first of all, partnering with communities is like one of my favorite things in the world for a lot of reasons, one of which, just very selfishly, I love experiencing how different communities pray and sing and feeling sort of let into their Torah. And every community davens differently, and every community sees, you know, what is like regular or like normal davening as differently. And that's one of my personal greatest joys, is sort of seeing what makes a community tick and what feels safe, what feels comfortable. And then I'd say part of what I ask and what I offer a community is, how do we take what is safe, important, comfortable, beautiful, and working, and dig deeper, and back to this question of secrets, sort of unearth some of the still unexcavated secrets of prayer and of song and of music that already exist in the way that shul is experiencing prayer together. I'll say that one of my first questions when I'm working with like the chazan or the rabbi or the, you know, ritual committee head or whoever it is that I'm working with to partner with joining a shul for a weekend or an experience, is I'll say, what are your Misinai melodies? So Misinai meaning sort of as though it's Torah from Sinai itself. Every community has their own Misinai melodies. Every community has the melodies that feel fundamental to the fabric of the Torah of the community. And that's always one of my first questions, because I see part of my work in bringing together the Misinai melodies and the Misinai-ness of prayer, and sort of marrying it to elements of newness to create that, you know, that Shir Chadash, that new song. And it starts with knowing what is really core to the musical identity of a community.
That's really beautiful. I find that a lot of synagogues, maybe not a lot, but certainly some, think that it is the new melodies that are going to help uplift and radically change the nature of their congregation. But we know, as your mentor and friend, as well as mine, Joey Weisenberg, likes to say, it's never the melody's fault, which is something I've really taken to heart.
That's very generous to some melodies to say.
Right. Maybe sometimes, I think maybe sometimes it is the melody's fault, but yes. Often it isn't. And that leads me to, like, not necessarily the core, because there have been many cores that we have been focusing on. But when you lead prayer, what are your hopes for the people in the congregation? Do you have a hope? Do you have a goal in mind for them? Why are they there? What can you help them do?
I think that's really interesting. I think I would have answered that question differently at different stages of my life and of my own understanding of what leading prayer can be. I actually think right now, one of my goals when I am the one leading prayer is to allow the community to see my vulnerability in the prayer and the ways in which I am human. That feels core to me at this moment. I'll just share a story. I was recently leading davening for a simcha, and it was a particularly complicated morning of davening in terms of the liturgy. It was Hanukkah, and there was Musaf, and there was Hallel, and there were, like, things that you only say on those times and days, and it was complicated. And I was aware of the intricacies of the tefillah, and I made the decision that if I were to stumble or if I were to feel the weight of those structural complications, that it would be okay if the kahal felt some of that. That I too could in fact do what I tried to teach, which is that I can both hold the responsibility of skilled and correct leadership for the sake of a community, and allow myself to be one of the people praying, to be one of the people vulnerable, and to be one of the people human, being human, and let that be. That feels very live for me right now, and I try to let that show up in that davening in that moment.
That's beautiful. And I would hope, even taking a step further, and feel free to correct me if this kind of doesn't go there in your mind, but through you being vulnerable, perhaps you give other people permission to be vulnerable themselves, because I think that prayer is an incredibly vulnerable act. Singing in front of people is vulnerable in a language that you don't totally understand, and opening your heart to some sort of emotion, it's all vulnerable. And to see the person at the front of the room or in the middle of the room, depending on where you are, the leader of prayer, not be perfect, can give everybody else permission that they don't have to be perfect either. And that can be really freeing.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it, that it can be freeing to be visibly human. And I also believe that there is, you know, it's really important to strive for, you know, accuracy and for skill. And I'm trying to instill in both my students and in myself the ability to both prioritize that and to not let that get in the way of being a prayer. That those have to both, I have to hold both. And that's also in some ways humility and chutzpah.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of self-compassion and compassion for others. I know I'm like that. Like, if the Chatzi Kaddish is quote unquote supposed to be one melody and the leader uses the other one, I'm out of it, right? It kind of takes me out of the flow. And there are plenty of reasons why someone wouldn't remember or know that that was the correct Chatzi Kaddish melody. And what can I do to steer myself back? I don't know if you ever have that problem.
Yeah, it's funny. That's such a, I love that example, because, you know, the Chatzi Kaddish is just to get really nerdy for a second.
Like, please.
I mean, look who we are. But in some ways, that's a great example of, like, there's like an error in Chatzi Kaddish melody that's so common across North American shuls at this point that sometimes if you don't make that mistake and you do it correctly, it can be jarring for folks because there are certain Nusach mistakes that over time have sort of almost taken on the weight of correct because of how frequently they're done. And honestly, that's midrash too. You know, there's something very midrashic about that I almost don't want to get in the way of. And at the same time, I also want to like solve that. So you just named one of my favorite examples of like the Chatzi Kaddish Nusach.
Yeah, that's definitely alive for me. As we kind of wind down our conversation together, I'm wondering if there's any composition of yours, piece of prayer music in particular, that you would want to raise up as a blessing for our listeners, as a prayer for our listeners, something to leave us with as we continue to think about this question and lean into the mystery of it all.
Thank you. I think I'd like to offer my melody for Mincha Meitzar, which is two verses from Psalm 118. And in the first verse of this song, the text reads, Mincha Meitzar Karati Ya, from a narrow place I cried out, Anani Vamerchav Ya, and God answered me from a place of expanse. And I always read this verse as like, maybe aspirational, because I know in the moments where I feel like I'm in the Meitzar, that I'm in the narrow place, I'm not like confident that God will answer me. It's like usually the opposite. So for a while I read it as aspirational. And then after reading that Midrash from Psachim about King David, I realized maybe it's not even that it's aspirational. It's that it's actually the disciplined practice of saying words that we don't even have the courage to believe yet, but the process of saying that is the first step to bringing on Shechina, or bringing on the Merchav, bringing on the expanse, that it is that there is a discipline in saying Anani Vamerchav Ya, God answered me. There's a discipline in saying that in the moment where you feel dafka, where you feel specifically the opposite. And I have a melody for that is very close to my heart, that I would like to offer as sort of a kavanah for all of us, an intention towards feeling the courage to lean into the discipline of saying words that are maybe hard, maybe confusing, maybe we don't even always believe, but they're in the service of sort of excavating the secrets.
Excavating the secrets. Thank you so much for your blessings and for joining us in this conversation today.
Thank you so much, Eliana. What a joy. Thank you for bringing me.
And thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much to Christy Dodge, our editor, who does an amazing job every single week. You can find The Light Lab on Facebook or Instagram at thelight.lab. Follow us. We've got some fun and exciting things coming up for the upcoming year. We hope you will join us in our exploration of Tefillah. And we will see you very, very soon. Bye, everybody.